Welcome to Conversations with Big Rich. This is an interview-style podcast. These interviewed are all involved in the off-road industry. Being involved, like all of my guests are, is a lifestyle, not just a job. I talk to past, present, and future legends, as well as business owners, employees, media, and land use warriors, men and women who have found their way into this exciting and addictive lifestyle we call off-road. We discuss their personal history, struggles, successes, and reboots. We dive into what drives them to stay active in off-road. We all hope to shed some light on how to find a path into this world that we live and love and call off-road.
Whether you're crawling the Red Rocks of Moab or hauling your toys to the trail, Maxxis has the tires you can trust for performance and durability. Four wheels or two. Maxxis tires are the choice of champions because they know that whether for work or play, for fun or competition, Maxxis tires deliver. Choose Maxxis. Tread victoriously.
Have you seen 4LO magazine yet? 4LO magazine is a high-quality, well-written, four-wheel drive-focused magazine for the enthusiast market. If you still love the idea of a printed magazine, something to save and read at any time, 4LO is the magazine for you. 4LO cannot be found in stores, but you can have it delivered to your home or place of business. Visit 4LOmagazine.com to order your subscription today. On today's episode of Conversations with Big Rich, I'll be talking with Dwayne Gerritsen. Dwayne is he's a family man. He's a off-road event promoter. He's actually a racer. He's owns a shop owner. He's been around off-road for a long time. We're going to dive into all of that. Dwayne, thank you for spending the time and coming on Conversations.
Yes, sir. Absolutely. Very glad to have to be on the show. Thanks for asking me. Excited to get started.
Okay, great. Let's do that. And I know that you live in Arkansas now. Is that where you were born and raised?
I was actually born in Omaha, Nebraska. Don't remember much. We moved from Omaha when I was three. So I've lived in Arkansas since I was three.
Okay. All right. That's fair enough. And you're always been in that Fort Smith area?
Yeah, pretty much. When we first moved to Arkansas, we were probably about 35 miles north. And then we moved to Fort Smith, and then we moved about 15 miles back north again. And I've been in a little town called Alma since 1984.
Okay. Been there quite a while.
Yes, sir.
And, the last time I was there, it's urban, but it has a rural feel to it. And I don't know if that's because the woods are so thick in that area. Is that a good description?
Yeah, I mean, the woods are really thick. You know, they do some controlled burns and stuff to try to thin some of that stuff out. But it is pretty thick as far as when you get into the mountains. Fort Smith is, you know, probably the largest city, obviously, that, you know, that the metropolis is surrounded around. So, you know, there's not a lot to do in Fort Smith as far as off-roading because it's pretty much just a city. But 20 minutes, you know, in almost any direction from Fort Smith, and you're in some pretty good wheeling, you know, whether you're in Oklahoma, you know, or Arkansas.
Okay. Excellent. And what was it like growing up there? Was it, was there always something to do, or did you find life boring at first?
Well, I guess when I was a little kid, you know, you always find stuff to do when you're little, but when I kind of moved into my, preteen years, maybe when I was around 10, I was, my parents were able to get me a moped. So, you know, I was able to ride my moped, you know, probably 5 or 6 miles from the house, you know, like with their permission, and, you know, 10 to 15 miles without their permission. So, you know, I guess I grew up pretty free spirited. You know, I had that moped and it sounds crazy, but that just gave me a whole bunch of independence. My parents both worked, you know, 6 to 6, seemed like, you know, 6-7 days a week to try to make all the ends meet. So, you know, me having my own transportation as a young kid, you know, I was able to drive to, you know, the Boy Scouts, or I was able to go to baseball practice, or, you know, when I got probably 12, they let me ride it, you know, back and forth to school. So I gained a lot of independence just by having, you know, transportation, I feel like.
Are you an only child?
No, I've actually got two older sisters. One that actually grew up in Omaha, the half sister, And then my sister that, you know, I grew up with my whole life that, you know, lived here and now I'm with me, and, you know, now she lives in Russellville, which is still pretty close.
But being the youngest, you were, they were, are they, how much older is your closest sister?
My closest sister is 3 years older than me. Okay. So, you know, and I was a boy, I was the baby, I was the young one. So, you know, I probably got away with a little bit more than she did.
The youngest always does. And if it's a boy, it, you know, you get a little bit more independence, I think.
Yeah. I mean, I felt like my parents, you know, give me a lot of leave room. You know, they would let me do whatever I kind of wanted to do more so. And then, you know, if I got in trouble, then, you know, they'd pull the leash a little tighter and, you know, they kind of let me learn from my own mistakes. So, you know, I felt like that really helped turn me into who I am.
Excellent. So you mentioned playing baseball. Did you do a lot of sports as a youth?
When I was a young child, you know, baseball was really about the only sport that I played, you know, as far as on the team. When I was little, we still had pretty much neighborhood gangs that, you know, ran around and played, you know, all summer together and after school together. You know, we played kickball and soccer and baseball and football and stuff. But organized sports, I pretty much stuck to baseball until seventh grade. And then in seventh grade, I signed up for the football team. First time I'd ever played football. And I kind of got hooked on that. In seventh grade, you know, you basically enter what we considered the academy, which would be you play for the school that you go to versus the little league format. Right. So when I got in seventh grade, I played for the, you know, the Alma Airedale junior high football team, and I also signed up for the track team. And then baseball just kind of just fell off the plate. You know, I started working in the summers when I was 13. So it was hard for me to play baseball and go to work. So I pretty much just focused on track and football all the way through high school.
And what did you run in track?
In track, I don't know how, but I ran the 100, the 220, and then I would run the 440 relay. Every now and then, they would let me do like the long jump or the shot put or whatever we needed, you know, an extra guy for. So I was pretty athletic as a young person. So, you know, I was pretty well-rounded, did a lot of stuff in track. In the football area, I was a running back and outside linebacker.
Nice. Very good. And at what point did you, you know, go from the moped to something a little more substantial?
Well, I think I got the moped around 10, and I actually got a Yamaha 50 Special motorcycle when I was probably about 12. So, you know, that was a lot faster bike. I could take it, you know, on the highways, you know, because it would do like 50, it'd do 51 miles an hour wide open, and the moped would only do like 28. So I was about 12, and I had that 50 Special. I'd worked all summer to buy it. My parents, you know, pitched in some money, helped me get it. And I actually rode that thing until I turned 16.
Okay. And at 16, you jumped into a car or a truck?
Like I said, I started working when I was 13, so I just turned 14, and I wanted an old Chevy. So my dad found me a 68 Chevy truck, and I'd been working, so I had some money saved up. And for $1,100, we bought a 68 Chevy Stepside. And it had a six-cylinder, you know, it needed some work. But when I was 14, I had, you know, I was reading Mini Trucking and Trucking Magazine and, you know, and all the hot stuff at that time. And I totally disassembled this truck. And me and my dad totally put it back together in my front yard.
Very good. Very good. And how long a project was that?
Well, I was really trying to get it ready by my 16th birthday. But at that point in my life, my dad was a truck driver. And, you know, I was just a stupid youth that didn't know much. So I kind of relied on him, you know, for everything. So I didn't really get to drive that truck until about 3 weeks after I turned 16.
Well, that's not too bad.
Yeah, but it was pretty close timeline. We did a good job.
What was the what were the jobs that you had when you said you started working at 13, 14?
Like the first real job I had, my mom has always been a server my whole life. And she worked at a place called Ginger Tree, which no longer exists, but Ginger Tree Restaurant. So my first job was they were super busy on Sundays. And I would go in there on Sundays and be the busboy. You know, and after a few months of being the bus boy, you know, then I turned into the bus boy slash dishwasher. And then, you know, I started working Saturdays and Sundays as just a dishwasher. And then, you know, then I picked up like a Monday night, and then I would do Saturday and Sunday and Monday. And it just it just kind of evolved into a job to where I was working there for probably 3 to 5 days a week, just depending on the scheduling and, you know, and what I had going on at school. And so I was just a dishwasher pretty much, you know. I got to do some short order cook stuff from time to time, but just restaurant industry.
Okay. And at what point was it in high school that you started that you moved away from that, or how did things progress from the restaurant?
Well, it sounds super crazy, but when I was 15, I was still working at the Ginger Tree restaurant. I'd been working there about 2 years and had a really good grip on, you know, the restaurant industry, I felt like, at a young age. And I was making $2.85 an hour.
Nice.
And my birthday was in October, so I was going to turn 16 in October, and I knew that I was going to be able to get minimum wage anywhere I went. So this was September, minimum wage was changing, and I asked my boss, I said, "Hey, man, you know, minimum wage is going to $3.15 here, you know, this month, and I'm turning 16. Or you're gonna bump me up to $3.15?" And he said, "You're out of your mind." And I was really taken back, you know, because I felt like I was really putting a lot of energy into this guy's restaurant, you know, and he wasn't going to give me, you know, 30 cents an hour at the time, you know, and I'm working 20 hours a week. So I was going to get like a $6 or $7 raise, and he turned me down. So I was super pissed. And I told my mom, you know, because she had worked there maybe 10 years at this point. And I told her I was going to look for another job and I was quitting. And I couldn't believe he wasn't going to pay me minimum wage. So I went to this place called Pizza Parlor. And it was about 2 blocks from my house. So it was super close to my house. And the job that I did have was about 8 miles from my house. So I was like, well, I'm going to go to this pizza place and see if I can get a job. And I filled out an application and the guy looked at it and he said, "Man, you've been in the restaurant industry for almost 3 years and you're not even 16. I said, "Yeah, that's right." And he said, "Man, when can you start?" So I was like, "Awesome." You know, so I went back and told my old boss, Bill. I said, "Hey, man, I found a new job. I'm quitting. You know, they're going to pay me minimum wage, you know, so good luck." And he's like, "Good luck to me." He's like, "Good luck to you." So anyhow, you know, I was like, well, it's strange, but whatever. So I go work at this pizza parlor place a couple weeks later. I had to give him a 2-week notice. That was, you know, mandated by my parents. So anyhow, maybe a month or 6 weeks go by, and I go to see my mom on Sunday. I wasn't working at pizza parlor that Sunday. So I go by to see my mom, and I see 2 guys doing my job. And I'm like, what's going on here? You know, like, I did all this by myself. And my mom's like, "I can't find somebody to keep up. Bill had to hire 2 guys. So I was really, really happy, you know, that he was spending $5 or $6 an hour when he could have been spending $3.15. So I just laughed and, you know, went about it.
that's always good when karma hits.
Oh yeah, it was a good feeling for me at a young age, you know. Like, I felt like I had a lot of worth at that time in the industry. So I started at this pizza parlor, you know, a couple weeks after I turned 16. And inside a year, I was the assistant manager, you know, because I had just had a lot of restaurant experience and I knew it was a fast paced industry and I was good at cleaning stuff and, you know, paying attention. And so anyhow, I ended up working at that pizza parlor for 10 years. I worked there until I was almost 26, and then I got a different job.
Okay. And what was what's that?
I went to work, and my uncle was a pipe fitter. And he did sprinkler systems. So I went to work for the sprinkler system company, you know, putting in, you know, sprinkler systems in factories and warehouses and stuff like that. And I was still pretty young, and I had these 2 guys, you know, that were just pressing me every single day to, you know, go to college, you know, blah, blah, blah. You know, you shouldn't be working here, you know. And these dudes are making like $16 an hour, you know, and like, I guess maybe 1996. And I was just like, man, you know, I can't make this kind of money, you know, working for somebody else, you know, if I just go get a college degree. So like, this, you know, this is a good job. It's a union job. I'm like, man, this is great. But actually, or ultimately, those 2 old dudes, man, just drove me crazy, because I was young, and they were both, you know, and they were in their late 50s, early 60s. And no matter what we had to do, I had to do it. You know, and I just felt like they didn't do anything, you know, and I just didn't really have a real good grasp of the seniority in a union style atmosphere, and it just drove me crazy. So anyway, I ended up getting out of that job, and just doing a couple other miscellaneous jobs here and there. And then I got a pretty good job working at a factory at Highland Dairy, working, you know, for a dairy processing plant, you know, that pasteurized and homogenized the milk, you know, turned it into actual, you know, drinkable product, chocolate milk, whatever. And, right. and I worked there for a few years. And about the same time that I'd started working at Highland Dairy, me and my business partner at the time started Come Get You Some. So, you know, I was working at Come Get You Some from, you know, 7:30 in the morning until about noon. And then we'd go eat lunch. And then I had to go to Highland Dairy from 1 to 9. And then, you know, I'd work at Come Get You Some on my days off and on the weekends and stuff like that. And then my business partner, you know, he worked pretty much 8 to 5. So we tried to start the business, kind of got it going. We rented another shop. Or not another shop, but we rented a shop with another person that was trying to start a business. So, you know, all of our overhead would be a lot less. And, you know, he had a few tools that, you know, we needed, and we had a few tools that he needed, you know, so we kind of leaned on each other and we kind of relied on each other to, you know, help pay the bills and help get things done. And after, you know, the 3 years, I guess about midway through, we had moved, we started that business in Alma, pretty close to my house. And, both of our businesses really started to grow a little bit, and we both needed all the space, and we were both ready to take all the overhead. So, you know, we decided, hey, if we're going to pay this much overhead and we need this much, you know, all the space, we really need to move to a little bit more populated area. You know, Alma's, you know, roughly 6,000 or 7,000 people at the time, and Fort Smith's probably, you know, 85,000 or 90,000 at the time. So I was like, man, we just really need to find a building in Fort Smith, you know, and try to take this thing to the next level. So, and we left on good terms. You know, he ended up staying in the building and renting the building, you know, himself for, you know, several months until he moved to somewhere actually bigger. His business really blew up. And we moved over here to the exact same building that I am now, but we were leasing at the time.
Okay.
So that kind of went on for probably maybe another year, year and a half. And then, you know, Come Get You Some and started to get so busy that I actually felt comfortable enough, you know, to leave my really good job and just come to work here, you know, full time. So that was probably around 2003. I'd actually quit, you know, my full-time job, day-to-day job, and just went to work for myself full time, you know, just relying on, you know, me and my partner to, you know, to make the bills.
So the start of Come Get You Some, your shop, how did that come about? You were working other jobs at the time, and you just became interested in off-road, or you know, what was that transition?
Well, I actually had a good friend of mine. I'd worked with his wife at Pizza Parlor for, you know, almost a full 10 years that I was there. She worked there too, and he was kind of into off-road, and he had a 1980 International Scout with a diesel motor. So it was kind of a unique vehicle, and it was pretty cool. And I did a lot of hunting with this guy. We did a lot of bow hunting. We did a lot of just regular hunting, you know, deer hunting and crow hunting and just random stuff, turkey hunting. So anyway, you know, we would always take his Scout almost anywhere that we'd go hunting. And I was like, man, I need to get me one of these four wheel drives. You know, this would be pretty cool. You know, I like doing this. So, you know, somewhere along the road there, I bought a 78 K5 Blazer, probably around 95, 96, I got this K5, and the very first day I got it, it snowed, and it really doesn't snow much here. So, you know, I got off work about midnight or whatever, and me and a few of my buddies loaded up in this K5 and just went back roading in the snow, and I was like, man, this is awesome. You know, like, I could really get into this, man, this is cool. So a little bit of time went by, and then me and that guy, his name's Kenneth Rawson. Me and Kenneth Rawson actually started a four-wheel drive club called the 4X Club. So, you know, we would meet up twice a month, and you know, we had maybe 10 or 12 other buddies, you know, that had Jeeps and different stuff. We would meet up and we'd be like, okay, we're gonna run this trail, you know, Kenneth's gonna be the trail leader and I'm gonna be the tail gunner, and we all had CBs, you know. And so we were really, you know, doing a lot of wheeling, you know. I mean, every 2 weeks we'd go on a trip somewhere and make it a public event. You know, social media wasn't, you know, available at that time. So it was all just flyers and telling our buddies and, you know, going to car shows and different stuff, trying to build our club into something cool. And the club started growing. at that point in time. So I was making some contacts primarily with a guy named Ray Sanchez that worked at 4Wheel Parts. And, you know, I talked to him and he got me fixed up with the, you know, a club discount. He's like, hey man, you know, if you buy all your parts through us, you know, we can give you 5% off or 10% off or, you know, whatever kind of room they had on whatever kind of product we needed. So at every meeting, you know, I would be like, hey guys, you know, I got this guy named Ray and he's a super cool guy. And he's giving us good deals on tires and wheels and lockers and tow straps, you know, whatever we need. So after maybe 6 or 8 months of this, you know, here I am like once a week making an order on 4Wheel Drive parts. So I was like, I kind of was known as the guy to call if you needed some 4Wheel Drive parts in the area. So I was like, man, this is pretty cool. You know, I'm making a little bit of money. You know, I was giving, you know, 95% of the discount to the guys in the club. You know, I wasn't really trying to make money. We were just all trying to save money and have a good time. But anyway, so that just kind of transitioned into me making, you know, maybe 5 or 10% on the parts to maybe trying to make 10 or 15% on the parts. And my business partner at the time, you know, he wasn't my business partner. He was working at actually about the only 4Wheel Drive shop in the area. And they had just opened up. And that guy, you know, my ex-business partner, his name was Cody Keller. He had his own, I guess you would call, shop. He didn't really have a shop, but, you know, he was working on 4Wheel Drive stuff at his house. So he was, he was pretty mechanical. His dad really helped him a lot, and he was a really good fabricator and welder. You know, he taught Cody a lot of stuff about four-wheeling, about fixing things, about welding, about fabricating, you know, just about all sorts of stuff, you know, that was, you know, on and off-road oriented. So anyway, when this new 4Wheel Drive shop started up, they had called Cody and they said, hey man, you know, we want you to be our guy. We want you to work here. So Cody's like, oh yeah, you know, he's super excited. You know, he was actually going to get to work at a real 4Wheel Drive shop and, you know, do what he loved to do. So he started working at the shop. And, you know, it wasn't maybe a week or two before he started working there. He called me up and he's like, hey man, you know, I'm working over here for this guy now at this shop. And I was like, yeah, I heard. And he's like, man, we don't really have a good parts supplier, you know. If I can get some parts sold, you know, would you be interested in, you know, in selling us parts? I said, absolutely, you know. And I'd already sold Cody and some of his customers parts, you know, previously to him working at the shop. So anyhow, we had a pretty good relationship going on. And, you know, he would call me in the morning or I would swing by their shop, you know, before I would go to my day job. And he'd be like, hey, man, I need to price this 456 ring and pinion, or I need to price a lock ride, or I need to price some Yukon gears, or, you know, just whatever. So I would call my guy at 4Wheel Parts and I was like, hey, man, you know, we're looking at these kind of parts or this lift kit or these tires or just whatever it was. And he'd give me a price. And then, you know, I'd call down there to the shop and be like, hey, man, I can get it for you for this much. And he's like, okay, yeah, get it. So at that point in time, you know, I had maybe 40 or 50 club members buying parts on a pretty regular basis. And then I had this shop and then I had a couple other little shops that were buying stuff. So, you know, I started to have a pretty good network of people that was buying a lot of parts from me. So I started to, you know, check into some different avenues and see what other types of parts that I could get, you know, associated with and be able to provide, you know, to my customer base at the time and maybe make a little bit more money. So anyhow, this kind of lingered on for maybe close to a year. And also during this year, I was off on Wednesdays. So it just so happened that, you know, we would, like say, we'd be looking for back in the time, maybe like a throttle body motor or turbo 400 or 205 or maybe some kind of select front axle housing. And I would get in my car and I would just drive to Missouri or Kansas or Iowa or, you know, Southern Arkansas. I would drive to these little weird towns and I'd go to the gas station. I'd be like, hey man, where's the biggest salvage yard or where's the closest salvage yard or who's got 50 cars in their yard that you know of? And I would go to these places just randomly and I'd be like, hey man, you know, I'm looking for this and I'm looking for this and I've got some customers looking for this. And I was able to create a pretty cool network of salvage yards to where I could just go around and pick all these parts up for all these, you know, customers that needed them. And anyhow, you know, a few weeks of that, maybe a few months of that, whatever, it was going pretty good. And Cody had decided that he wanted to go with me one day. He's like, hey, man, you know, I've got a customer that needs this, you know, and I know you're going and getting all this stuff. You know, you mind if I ride with you? And I was like, no, man, that'd be cool, you know. And at the time, I had my son. He was about three, so he wasn't in daycare or anything at the time, and I would just take him with me. So me and Drake would load up, and then Cody started going with us. And we'd go around to, you know, salvage yard to salvage yard every Wednesday and get as much stuff rounded up as we could. And, you know, sometimes we would buy stuff that we didn't necessarily have a buyer for, but we knew it was going to be, you know, we knew it was going to be sellable. So we just started collecting parts and rounding up stuff and building a bigger customer base and meeting more people and getting more connected. And things were just going really good. That went along for maybe another 2 or 3 months, 4 months. I don't even know. And then, you know, Cody's boss at the time was like, hey, man, you know, you called in sick like every Wednesday for like the past 2 months. Like, you know, what's going on? You know, and I don't know the conversation they had, but, you know, it basically turned into the guys like, OK, cool. You know, I'm cool with that, but I need you guys to get me these parts. So, like, I want you to find me this motor. I want you to find me this transfer case. I want you to find me this. And we were like, okay, cool. You know, he knows what we're doing. This is awesome. He's cool with it. You know, we'll get him some parts, and, you know, we'll get our parts, and we'll all make money, and it'll all be awesome. So anyhow, maybe 2 or 3 months of this going on, and, you know, and that shop's still buying, you know, the week to week, you know, ring and pinions or tires or lockers or lift kits or whatever they needed that I could provide for them. Plus, you know, we were going out and buying all these used parts. And at first, the guy was giving us money, and we were buying the parts, and it was good. And then, you know, as things went on, he stopped giving us money. We were using our own money. And then we would give him parts, and, you know, and then he would owe me, say maybe he would owe me $1,000 for the week's worth of parts, and then he'd owe me another $1,500 for used parts. And then it just kind of progressed into, now the dude owes me $3,000, you know. Well, now this week the dude owes me $4,000, and I, you know. And it was kind of weird, but, and I don't know, you know, if I looked at Cody or Cody looked at me, but I was like, hey, man, what are we doing? Like, we're using all our own money, and this guy's making all the money. You know, I mean, you know, sure, we're making a little bit, but, you know, we're barely paying for our gas and our lunch, and this guy's making all the money. Like, you know, he's making all the money on the install, he's making all the money on the parts, and we're using our money. Like, this is crazy. So anyhow,
he had a good deal, you know, going.
Yeah, he had an awesome deal going, you know, and roughly at that point in time, you know, that's when me and Cody decided that we were going to start our own business, you know, and it was going to be Come Get You Some. And, you know, we had a good enough network and a good enough, you know, customer base and, you know, a good enough name in the area that, you know, we thought we could make it work. But, you know, at that point in time, I had three kids. I guess Drake must have been 4 or 5. But anyway, so I had three kids, you know, and my partner at the time, you know, he was single. So I kept my regular job for insurance and benefits and to make sure I could pay my house payment, you know, and all my kind of stuff. And, you know, we said, hey, man, we're going to go to the bank. We're going to get a loan. You know, we're going to buy some equipment. We're going to start this business. It's going to be awesome. And we go to the bank. And we're sitting there, and, you know, I've got a loan officer that I've dealt with for a long time. And he was actually, his family was tied into the Ginger Tree. That was my first job. So, you know, I've known this dude maybe, you know, 15 years at this point in time. And like, hey, man, we want to get a loan. You know, we're going to start this business. And he's like, what do you got for collateral? And we're like, man, you know, we ain't got shit, you know. I mean, I've got some personal things. You know, I own a house at this point in time. And I've got some cars and stuff. And he's like, well, you know, what does your partner have? And I was like, well, you know, he don't have anything. You know, he still lives at home with his parents. You know, he's probably 5 years younger than me, you know? So anyhow, pretty big slap in the face. But at that point in time, they said, man, all we can really do with no collateral, you know, is give you a signature loan for $2,500. And at that point in time, you know, I didn't want to risk my house or my vehicles or any of the things that I'd worked hard for to start this business with the partner that, you know, really didn't have a lot to bring to the table at that time, you know, other than, you know, knowledge and resources, but no financial backing. So I was like, man, you know, how the hell are we going to do this with $2,500? Like, you know, we, you know, we're going to be able to buy a welder and, you know, no inventory, maybe an air compressor. So anyway, pretty big shocker, man. And at that point in time, that's when we kind of decided to team up with our buddy that was, you know, his name was Chancey Cockrum, and he was starting Cockrum's Welding. And that's when we both rented the same building and, you know, and we can make this $2,500 work, you know.
Perfect.
So that was around 2001. And fortunately, man, you know, I bought my partner out in 2016. So it worked good for both of us for a long time, you know. And then when it didn't start working so well, I was able to secure the business by myself. And we're still rocking and rolling.
Excellent. And when did you guys start doing the Madness event?
Well, actually, when we started the 4X Club, probably around 96, you know, we had a bunch of stuff going on and we did little things. And we actually had, you know, what we considered Madness in May. The first year that we had Madness in May was as a club. The 4X Club put it on. It wasn't as a business. And I believe it was in 2000.
Okay.
And, you know, around that time frame is when, you know, I'd started, you know, my own business. And, you know, obviously I wanted, you know, all the people in the club to buy all their parts from me. And, you know, and I knew that if they didn't, then I would have some, you know, my attitude might not be so good, you know, because I felt like, you know, we built this, you know, we got this club. And like, you know, you guys, you know, you're part of this club, you know, you should support us. So really just kind of stepped back and looked at the overall picture. And I was like, man, I really shouldn't be the president of this four-wheel drive club and own this company, because I know there's going to be a lot of friction between the club members and me just based on what I feel like they should do and what they're probably really going to do. So, you know, that was good insight for me to actually, you know, step back and be like, hey man, I need somebody else to run this four-wheel drive club because I'm starting this business. And at that point in time, we did get a new president, and, you know, and I helped with all the stuff, you know, I still filled the role of the president as much as I could, but I didn't make the decisions, and, you know, and I took a lot of pressure off myself. So, the first year was 2000. We did Madison May, at a place called Birds Adventure Center. And then that next year, the club pretty much just fell apart. Nobody wanted to do anything. Nobody wanted to be in charge. You know, when there was a decision to be made that might hurt somebody's feelings, nobody wanted to say anything to anyone or whatever. And it was just a disaster. So
that sounds pretty 2000. That sounds pretty typical.
Yeah. I mean, of a club, you know, and we had a really good thing going for 4 or 5 years, but you know, it just, without somebody really, you know, being in charge and, you know, basically having to be like the boss, you know, being the bad guy when somebody needed to be the bad guy, it just didn't work so well. You know, the current president wanted to be friends with everyone, and, you know, everyone does. But, you know, when something wasn't going so good, he didn't want to say anything about it. You know, of course, other members would get mad and then they wouldn't say anything. And then a group of members would kind of, you know, separate from the club and kind of try to start their own thing. And it was just a disaster as far as the club goes. But, you know, the good thing is that, you know, I went to the next meeting and, you know, I asked the guys that were in charge, I was like, hey man, you know, this is falling apart. You know, me and Come Get You Some, we want to take Madness in May and we want to make it our own event. You know, we want to make it like a customer appreciation event where we can have our own event every year and we can have our customers come out and we can do competitions and, you know, we can do cool stuff. You know, but, you know, I don't want to just take this, even though I started it. You know, you guys, you know, everyone helped me start it. You know, I didn't start it by myself. Can Come Get You Some, take Madness in May and make it our own event. And at that point in time, they're like, yeah, that's great. Cause you know, we're done, you know, we're done with it. We don't want to mess with it. So in 2001 was the first year that Come Get You Some did Madness in May as an event, you know, as a business.
Very good. Okay. And when did you get to the point where you thought, okay, now I have to start, I want to start competing? And where did you compete first?
Well, yeah, I mean, it all kind of started at the same time, you know, around, you know, I mean, in 96, when we started the four-wheel drive club, you know, it's just like, we're all competing against each other. You know, who can make this hill climb? Who can go through this mud hole? Who can, who can do this and who can't do this, you know. So it was definitely a friendly competition, you know, amongst peers. And, you know, and that led to spending more money on bigger tires and more lift kits and better lockers and different winches and, you know, different stuff like that, which is just kind of the progression of four-wheeling in general. But in 2001, we actually had a competition, you know, to where, like, we'd set up, you know, maybe like a creek crawl or a woods course, you know, and like whoever the fastest team could drive through this would win, you know, a winch or some free t-shirts or, you know, whatever the prizes were for the competitions. And at that point in time, I really wasn't getting to compete because we were trying to run it out of business, you know, and I didn't want people to be like, oh, well, you know, he's winning, or, you know, he's doing well, but he owns it, you know, he's cheating. So right. It really, I really didn't get to compete at Madison May until probably around 05 or 06, to where, you know, we had pretty capable rigs and we're like, man, you know, and there's another event up there at the same place called Rocktoberfest, and they had competitions, you know, and we've been competing in the competitions at Rocktoberfest since probably 2002. So, you know, maybe 2004, 2005, you know, the base of competitors, you know, in the area are like, man, why don't you compete at your event? I'm like, well, because I don't want you guys to cry when I beat you, you know, or whatever, you know. And like, oh, no, man, it ain't like that. You know, we want you to compete. So, you know, we were kind of competing in our own event, you know, as much as we could. We were competing at Rocktoberfest, you know, several other little off-road things in the area had popped up here and there. And I can't remember that guy's name, Sports in the Rough, Bob Hazel.
Bob Hazel, yep.
Yeah, Bob Hazel came to town, you know, with his big promotion and the Ramsey Winch stuff. And he had a few competitions, and we went to those, and we had competed in those. And, you know, he had one maybe around 2007 or 8 called Ozark Mountain Adventure Games, which was, you know, invite only. So we actually got invited to this, you know, so we're competing against like the 10 best guys in the area. And being a kid that was actually working for me at the time, Derek Davis, I had a 70 model Bronco on 42s. We went and entered this thing with this Bronco man, and, you know, somehow we come out on top, you know, kicked all their asses and was like, yeah, man, this is awesome. You know, we can actually do this, man. So bunch of local stuff, you know, since probably 97, 98, for sure, starting in, you know, in 2001, like, you know, like in a competition setting. But as far as like, really competing, like, you know, competing with people that, you know, are very like-minded and wanting to spend money and wanting to really, you know, step up their game, that's when in 2007 we had built the We Rock Mod Stock car, and we decided that we were going to compete in We Rock and we were going to compete in R Rock in Hannibal, Missouri.
Right. Okay. And that's when we did the All Stock Nationals.
Yeah, we did All Stock Nationals. I can't remember. I'm pretty sure.
It was either seven or eight. Hannibal.
Yeah, I think that was in Hannibal.
It was, yeah.
Yeah, I think it was in eight. I think Hannibal All Stock Nationals was in 2008. But I want to say I'm 99% sure my first We Rock ever was in Dayton, Tennessee. And I think it was in 07. Because at the time, I had a young kid that worked for me, and he's still a really good friend of mine, Jeff Spear.
Right.
He was my spotter. So, and I had a good buddy, Justin Lawson. He had built a Pro Mod car. So, you know, Justin and Cody were going to run the Pro Mod class, and me and Jeff were going to run the Mod Stock class. And I don't even know how it came up, but a buddy of mine had sent me a blow up doll. So we're like, man, it'd be funny, you know, if we put this blow up doll on this Jeep. And, you know, drive it from Arkansas to Tennessee, you know, I mean, how many people are going to laugh at us and look at us and stuff. So we thought that was really cool. You know, we were just young and dumb. So we strap old Roxanne in the passenger seat of this Mod Stock car, drive to Dayton, Tennessee. And we get lost. We don't even really know where we're at. We find this motel about 2 a.m. where we're supposed to be staying. And we check in and we go in and we crash out. And we're like, man, you know, we're going to start competing in the morning. You know, we got to wake up early. And, you know, in Dayton, you know, I mean, you know, you've been there hundreds of times. It's, you know, it's 15, 20 minutes outside of town.
Absolutely.
So we get up early, man, and we're like all geared up, ready to go. And we're walking down the hallway and we see this maintenance guy, and he just starts laughing at us. You know, we're kind of shocked, you know, we're running on about 4 hours sleep. And we're like, dude, you know, what's so funny? He's like, man, I'm sorry, man. I'm sorry. He comes up to us. He starts apologizing. And we're like, dude, what are you sorry about? And he's like, man, I had to cover your doll up. He said, we got a group of church parishioners that came into town, and they are pissed. So they are freaking out because you got this doll out there. He said, and the management made me go put a sheet on it. And we're like, oh, man, that's cool. You know, no problem. We weren't really trying to offend anybody. We're just trying to be funny, you know. And anyway, he's like, no, man, it's funny. It's super funny. He's like, but these guys are mad. So anyhow, we make it through breakfast without, you know, getting cast into hell, and make our way up to Dayton. And that was the first time that I'd met you in Dayton, Tennessee in 2007.
Kazars, yep.
Yeah, so, super cool place, man. Super cool.
Yeah, it's a really nice venue for spectators to watch. It's probably, you know, they get to sit on the grass and watch everybody on the rocks, and they don't even have to move around. You can just about see everything.
Yeah, yes. I mean, just spectator-wise, you know, and even from a competitive standpoint, man, it's one of the coolest places that you can actually go to. We rock.
Excellent. Glad to hear that. And then you competed at Hannibal Rocks as well?
Yeah, we signed up for Hannibal Rocks, you know, just because it was about 6 hours from the house. And that seemed like it was, you know, I felt like a lot of the guys that were running We Rock that we were going to compete against were running our rock. And like I said, it was pretty close. So we signed up for our rock and we got up there and, you know, we met Tom and Debbie, you know, which are still, you know, lifelong friends of mine, man, great people. We started competing in that, you know, at that course. We had a local guy, Kyle Brusso, that had already been running We Rock, you know, in his YJ. So he was running our rock too, you know, so we're like, we knew a few people, you know, we could learn some stuff. We could go up here, you know, get some experience. And we spent a lot of time at, you know, at Hannibal, Missouri doing the R Rocks, man, and had just a great time.
And did you ever compete with Mo-Rock?
Yeah, we did run some Mo-Rock. Wasn't really the technical rock crawling stuff when we started competing with them, which, you know, I don't know if it ever was. But the Mo-Rock was kind of like what I would maybe say when we started, at least, like the beginner level XRA.
Right.
It was, you know, it was short, fast courses to where, you know, everything was, you know, not necessarily, you know, We Rock, you have a time limit, you know, and you're trying to, you know, navigate a course, you know, through the cones and stuff and be real technical. And Mo Rock, the technical was pretty much gone, and it was pretty much smash the gas and go as fast as you can and try not to die. So we did run some Mo Rock, man, and it was super fun. And, you know, and I think that maybe was similar to the stuff that we had been doing, you know, at Madness of Man Rocktoberfest, where everything was pretty much based on fastest time.
Right.
But we ran Mo Rock. We ran Mo Rock. They had a couple events, and like they had one in Texarkana, Arkansas. They had one in Garland County around Hot Springs, Arkansas. But the majority of the Mo Rock we ran was up at Smore.
Which is a good place to go fast.
Yeah, it was excellent, man. And then, you know, at that point in time, I had another buddy that, you know, I met through, you know, through Justin Lawson with the We Rock car. They went to high school together, Matt Allen, who, you know, actually ended up being, you know, one of my We Rock squatters for a long time, too. Well, Matt had a pretty nice YJ on 42s with a Hemi. Well, he started racing the Mo Rock with us. And, yeah, we did. It's a Mo Rock, man. It was a good time. I don't know what happened to that series. You know, I don't know if it was financial or medical, or they just got bored, or, you know, maybe it's park restrictions, but that they just kind of dropped out. I'd have never heard really.
Yeah. I think it was a combination of a lot of work. And if you're not doing it as a primary, as your job, event promotions, when you're trying to put together a series, can be very difficult. And you got to buy in all the way to it to really make it work. And I think that's been the downfall of a lot of event promoters, is that, you know, they're trying to, you know, do their regular job or business, and then they want to put on events as well. And one event a year is not bad, but all of a sudden when you start getting into a series, you know, there's just, especially if you're moving it around, there's just so many details that will have to come together to make it work, and travel and everything else, that it's really hard to do both.
Oh yeah. I can't imagine. I mean, from a competitor standpoint, you know, we want to bitch and whine and cry about what didn't go our way, or, you know, how come we're driving so far. But yeah, I totally cannot imagine trying to navigate the possibilities of, you know, setting up 10 or 15 events throughout the country at different parks with different people and different time frames. That's just, yeah, that's, I definitely give you guys credit for that, man. That's got to be an enduring task.
Well, it is, but it's a labor of love for those that that buy into the lifestyle. That's for sure. So, yeah, I remember when Jesse Haynes put on his first Silver State rock crawl, and he came to me afterwards, and I said, so at one of our events, and I said, so how was it? And he goes, I don't know how you do more than one event. He goes, I live, you know, 15 minutes away from the event site, and it took me all year to get ready. And I'm like, yep.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's not, it's, you know, it's just like going into business, you know, I mean, you just, you go full steam and, you know, you have goals and you drive to it. So let's talk about the transition into, you know, you guys ran the WeRock mod stock class for quite a while. And I thought that you guys were doing really well. The mod stock class has gone away. Nobody really competes in it anymore. And I think it's because of the full body restrictions and all that kind of stuff. It's hard for people to go out and, you know, try to keep a full body vehicle going all year long, you might say. But did you ever step up into the pro mod class yourself?
No, we ran WeRock in the same mod stock car. We started in 07 and we ran until the 2015 season. In 2015, me and Matt Allen won the championship, and I think it was in Cedar City, Utah.
Right.
But really moving, you know, probably I would say maybe around 2013, the mod stock class really just started dying. So there wasn't a lot of competitors. So we ended up racing or, you know, competing, I guess, in, well, I guess you may still have it, the sportsman class.
Correct.
So, you know, we would get there on 35s in a full body rig, and we'd be competing against a single side, you know, a single seat car with 40s and rear steer. And it just, man, we were just beating our head against the wall. We were still doing pretty good, but, you know, we weren't doing as, you know, we weren't dominating like we wanted to be, you know, with like-minded people and like-minded, you know, same class style cars.
Right.
So it just really started getting more and more difficult. But, you know, at the same time that the WeRock started getting kind of funky for us in the mod stock class, I want to say maybe you started dirt riding around 2014 or 15.
Yeah, I think it was a little earlier. That. Yeah, it was before that. But yeah, we, you know, we did. And you transitioned over to dirt riot.
Yeah, so, you know, we put some bypass shocks on the rear of our car that we could take off and put the WeRock stuff back on. So we were using the car basically dual purpose. You know, we were running whatever classes we could. And a lot of times in dirt riot, we'd run two classes. But we'd run as many classes as we could in dirt riot. And then we'd change the car just very minimal. And we'd go to a WeRock. So we were doing, you know, we were racing the car as fast as we could. And we were still, you know, technically crawling the car. And, you know, at that point in time, probably around 2000, maybe the end of 14, the beginning of 15, I'd started, you know, looking at the Ultra 4 series because, you know, we were doing decent in the dirt ride, you know, with the WeRock car. I thought, man, if we could get a real race car, you know, we could be, you know, we could probably do this. You know, we could be competitive. We could, you know, we could do some stuff and have a lot of fun. So, started looking around. Pirate was still relatively popular in 2014, 15. It was starting to fade away some, you know, and social media was really starting to gain a lot of traction. So we started looking, you know, everywhere we could. And I seen some SpiderTrax axles on, I think it was on Pirate, and, this guy named Randy Rod. So I'm like, okay, cool, man. I'm going to contact this dude. And I contact this guy. And I'm like, hey, man, I see you got these axles for sale. And he's like, yeah. He said, we're up here at Jimmy's 4x4. And I was like, oh, yeah, man, I heard of you guys. You know, I'd met Derek West through WeRock, and he's still a good friend of mine. And he had some Jimmy's cars. So, I'd heard of Jimmy's 4x4. And Randy's like, man, what's your name? And I said, Dwayne Garrison. He's like, man, I said, I'm super busy right now. Let me call you back. So I was like, well, that was weird, but okay. So anyhow, dude hangs up, and I'm like, well, you know, wonder what he wants for these axles. You know, I didn't even really get to talk to him. So he calls me back about 2 hours later, and he's like, "Man, you say your name's Dwayne Gerritsen?" I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Man, I want to build you a car. I want to build you a race car." And I was like, "Man, that sounds great, but I'm poor as shit, and I can't build you. You know, I've seen what you got. I can't, you know, I just can't even fathom you guys building me a race car, man. Like, I can't afford it. You know, it's just not happening. That's why I'm looking at these busted Spider Tracks axles and Pirate, you know, see if I can put something together." And he's like, man, we're going to talk about this, man. We're going to talk about this. I'm going to send you an email. So he gets my email, you know, and he's like, "Man, what kind of parts can you provide for this car? Like, talk to all your sponsors or your marketing partners, you know, tell them you're building this, you know, this car, and, you know, you want the most help you can get, you know, the best discounts or free parts, or, you know, like, let's put a list together, man. Let's see what we can do." So I'm like, "Man, you know," so Randy's an excellent salesman.
Yes.
So he gets me all pumped up, and I'm like, "Shit, we're building a race car, you know, this is going to be awesome." So I'm all pumped up, you know, and I'm, you know, hitting up all of our marketing partners at the time. And I'm like, "Hey man, you know, we've been doing pretty good in this dirt ride. You know, we've won some national championships and some WeRock, and, you know, we've been in rock sports for a while. You know, we feel like we can do this, you know." And the support was really just super good, man. Like, you know, the economy was doing good in 15 and 16. So I had really good support from a lot of our marketing partners. And I talked to Randy, you know, multiple times on the phone, and we kind of got this thing dialed in. And, you know, at that point in time, we decided we wanted to race a 4,500 car because we knew we were never going to be able to afford a 4,400 car and, you know, and maintain the competitiveness that I would like to maintain. Like, you know, I've got this weird mindset. If I don't feel like I can win, I don't want to be there.
Right.
But I mean, if there's a 4% chance that we can win, I want to be in. You know, I'm all in. Let's do this. You know, let's do it. But the 4,400 class was growing so fast, and the amount of dollars that were being spent on those cars was just, you know, I just couldn't wrap my head around it. So anyway, we had decided on a 4,500 car. At that point in time, the 4,800 class was still considerably slower as a group than the 4,500 class.
Right.
So I was like, this is the fastest car that we can build, that we can afford to race, you know, and afford to build. So let's build a 4,500. So anyway, that in 2000, I guess maybe in the end of 15, we were there in Cedar City, Utah, and we won the WeRock Championship, and Randy was there, you know, and he come over, and that's the first time I really got to meet him in person. So, you know, we discussed a bunch of stuff, man, and it wasn't very long after that, man, I started shipping parts to Jimmy's 4x4, and we were on the lake bed for 2016 KOH.
Excellent. And how did that race go for you?
Man, at that point in time, I had a buddy of mine, Groundy Carter, that was actually riding in the dirt ride races with me. And he was all in for helping me build the car and getting it ready. And, you know, so Groundy was my co-driver, and the race, man, really went super good. I mean, like super good, you know, cause we were doing great. We had broke a steering box early on, which, you know, we didn't realize was going to be such a nemesis, but we broke that box, and, we finally got it repaired. You know, we didn't know what we were going to do. And I had a spare box, but we couldn't get the pitman arm off, and we just didn't have all the right tools, man. We were just ill prepared, but we ended up taking the spare box apart and putting the parts in the new box that we needed in the box. And we were trying to put this O-ring in the top cap, and we couldn't figure out how to get it in there because it was like, you know, a 16th too big, and it kept popping out, and it kept popping out. I was like, "Man, this is driving me crazy. Like, how can we get this O-ring in here?" I'd reached in my pocket and I pulled out a tube of Raceline chapstick. And I was like, "Man, this is it." So I smeared all that chapstick in the top of that cap, and that O-ring sat down in there just perfect, and we were able to put it together and actually get out of there. But we were about finishing that up or whatever. We were about 2 miles from the finish, and the injectors were so plugged up that the car would only run for like 16 or 18 feet, and it would die. And I'd have to let it cool off for a little bit, and it would run 16 or 18 feet. So we actually finished our first King of the Hammers. But we finished like, I don't even really remember. I want to say it was like 28 minutes after the time limit. But we did finish. So, you know, we were like, "Man, you know, we did it. We can do this. You know, we're only going to improve. Like, we're going to keep pushing."
You know, the best stories are those, not necessarily of the winners, because that means you probably had a really good day Nothing probably went wrong, and you just cruised to the win. Those stories, the best stories, come out of those hardships of trying to finish.
Oh yeah, absolutely. You know, and it sounds crazy, but you know, a lot of times, you know, the guys that have been to the races with me, they know what they're going to hear. But like when we got a new guy, he's like, "Man, what am I going to do?" You're like, "What do I do? Like, I'm going to be in the pits. Like, what do I do?" And I'm like, "Dude, I hope you don't do a damn thing. I hope you sit over there and suck on that water bottle until we finish."
Yeah,
like, you know, because you're right. I mean, you know, the uneventful stories are the ones, you know, where actually everything goes super smooth.
Yes, so true. That's why it's hard to write like an article for the magazine about a race event and talk about the winners, you know, because their race, you know, there's very little that went wrong or was drama or anything like that. You know, maybe they were changing the, you know, back and forth in the lead, but you know, ultimately, you know, there's not the in-depth story of survival of, you know, trying to preserve, to finish when everything is against you. And, you know, it makes for a better story to listen to the people that didn't win.
Oh yeah, I totally agree. I mean, yeah, most of your memories and stories are definitely, like you said, going to be, you know, part of the hardship. I mean, you know, and that's what makes the story, you know, the things that you did endure and the things that you did come back from and, you know, how you made, you know, lemons out of lemonade. That's definitely the story people want to hear.
Right. So let's step into this year's KOH. You know, you had one of those days that you were able to pull off the win and be at the top of the podium. What was that day like? Was there drama?
Man, we really didn't have hardly any drama at all. You know, just like you said, we started it. We had a really good qualifier. We decided that, you know, we didn't want to really push as hard as we could to qualify, but we wanted to be maybe top 25, you know, in between the two classes. Now they mix the 48 and the 45 together based on your time. So we're like, man, if we can be top 25, you know, we'll be pretty happy. So we didn't really try to kill it in qualifying, but we finished third in class and 13th overall. So we're like, okay, cool. You know, we have some cars to catch, you know, but there's still a lot of fast guys behind us, man, that, you know, we're hoping don't catch us. So we start the race, 13th. We, you know, the dude, we get the whole shot, and then we come around the second turn and we're next to Justin Barth, and man, he's pushing, you know, and I was like, man, we're just going to let this guy go. You know, like there's no sense in crashing this car in the first, you know, quarter mile. So we let Justin go, and then, you know, we get off the short course, and we're running through the wash on the backside of King Mountain, and the dust is just crazy. And I'm like, man, that was a bad decision. You know, we really should have pushed a little harder to get in front of him because, you know, now we got 13 miles of this shit. So anyhow, we come over the Baldwin jump or whatever they call it, and we're heading down out into the desert, and we're still behind Justin. He's pushing hard. You know, we're just staying on his tail, trying not to crash. We get out into the, you know, closer to the Marine base, and the dust is so thick and so crazy that you can realistically only see probably 15 feet in front of your car, if that. So, you know, we're driving 65 miles an hour, possibly looking for nothing but taillights. And I'm like, man, this is crazy, you know. So the wind, and there's no wind at this point in time. And then the wind picks up just a little bit, and the wind is blowing from, you know, right to left. So, you know, Jeremy's like, man, get over here on the right, get on the right. So at KOH, you got 150 feet from the center line. So we pull out on the right, and we're in clean air, you know, for the first time. You know, we're probably 3 miles, 4 miles from, you know, the start, and we're in clean air. And I'm like, man, this is awesome. And I can see a car up there maybe 2 miles in front of us on the left-hand side. And I know based on where that car started – that there's probably four more cars in the middle of that dust. Yeah. So, and why they're not breaking out, I don't know. Maybe they broke out on the left and we couldn't see them or whatever, but we just outmotored this guy in the front, and we passed like four cars in the first 6 miles, and we got clean air, and we're like, man, this is awesome. So, the biggest thing that we didn't know was we didn't know our fuel economy. When we pre-ran, our fuel consumption was about twice of what it normally was. So we were scared to death that we weren't going to be able to make it back to Maine. So we decided we're going to stop in pit one. We're going to get some fuel and we're going to do, you know, a race calculation, like, you know, balls out. What are we really getting? So anyhow, we're sitting really good. We pulled into pit one. We're still sitting good. We had already passed the leader in our class and the guy in second place. So at this point we're in first place, but we're about to pit, you know, lose our position. So we're kind of down, but, like, you know, we got a full day of racing. So we pull into the pits and we get some fuel and we roll out and they tell us, you know, how much fuel we use. I'm like, okay, cool. You know, we're going to skip main pit. We can get to two. Now we know kind of where we're at. We get back in the groove. We just start picking off cars, man, just one by one. A couple 4,800 cars do pass us. You know, they're driving, you know, insanely fast. And, you know, at this point in time, I feel like I'm a KOH veteran. You know, I've been there about eight times. And I'm like, man, those dudes aren't going to finish. You know, like, there's no way that car's going to be able to take that much abuse. You know, it's just not. So, you know, like, against what I believe in, you know, all out, we're, you know, we're running the car about 75 or 80%, trying to be cool. We just keep passing cars, keep passing cars. You know, we get to the rock sections. Doing really well. I'm, you know, Jeremy's helping me pick lines and we're picking really good lines and the car's just working good and we're not having any problems. Things are just going great, man. We get to, I don't even remember what trail we get to, but anyway, Outer Limits. I think we're at Outer Limits and we see another 4,800 car all stuck and winched, man. We pick a great line, go right around and we're like, man, this, you know, this is awesome. Get up in there and we get all kind of stuck. And I'm like, we're super bellied up. The car's turtling around, you know. So, you know, 5 years ago, I'd have been like, just hang on. But I'm like, I stopped the car. I'm like, Jeremy, get out. You know, winch the car. Like, we, you know, we're not breaking the car. Get out. So he gets out. He hooks up the strap. We get out of there. We get to the pit. We pinch the sidewall. And at that point in time, I didn't even know we had a flat because it was on the – it was on the left rear, I believe, and never really felt it. So that was super cool. The pit's like, man, you got a flat. So we change the flat. Like, okay, cool. Everything else looks good. We take off. We're just driving Miss Daisy, man. It sounds super crazy, but we're just taking it easy. You know, we're running hard in the desert, you know, as hard as we feel like we can and keep the car together. All the rock trails are just really coming together good, man. We get to we come back through main pit. Everything's good. We get to sledge, and everybody's winching on sledge. And, you know, we had decided, you know, because this year our option was to go up jackhammer, and then you had a few options there, or to go up sledgehammer. And I tell Jeremy, you know, we make a team decision. If we're in the top 10 cars, we're going to go up sledgehammer, and if we got to wait and we got to winch, then that's fine. You know, that's going to definitely be the fastest route. So, you know, we feel like even if we have to wait a minute or two, you know, jackhammer's pretty rough and it's a lot longer trail. So anyhow, we get on sledgehammer and we navigate that thing, man, super good. And we get to the big climb and I just kind of look at Jeremy and he kind of looks at me and I was like, man, you know, when we pre-ran this, there was like 25 people in this canyon. So we just winched to save the car and be smart. We pull the front tires up on it, man, just give it a little throttle, car jumps right up the ledge. Like, we are super stoked. Jeremy's like really stoked because he don't got to get out. So we just kind of navigate the rest of the way, you know, through sledgehammer and get to the mailbox. And I was like, man, like, we are sitting really good, man. Like, we've got, you know, we've got to be like in the top 10 of this race. Like, no doubt, man. I mean, I know a couple 4,800s passed us, but we had passed a lot of those guys too, you know, just stuck on the side of the trail broke or stuck in the rock canyons or whatever. I'm like, man, you know, hell, we might be like in the top five, you know, like we're killing it, man. So every time that we could stop in the pits, we did. And I'm sure that cost us some time. But, you know, I've pulled out of the pits so many times and been, you know, a mile further down the track and blow a driveline or lose a steering heim or something. It's like, man, we're going, you know, we're sitting really good. Let's not blow this. So we roll into the pits. Our pit crew did an amazing job, man, of making sure everything on the car was good. And we'd take back off and get back on track. You know, we might lose a position or two to a 4,800 car, but I don't think we ever really got past about 4,500 car in the pits beyond pit one. So, you know, we just, our confidence was good. We just kept the car moving forward. I tried to slow down in some of the rock trails just to save the tires because, you know, in previous years, you know, we went through, you know, two tires, four tires, maybe six tires, you know, just really feeling like there was so much pressure to hurry up. And really, you know, I feel like all that pressure you're putting on yourself to hurry up ends up costing you, you know, more time.
Yeah,
because you have all these problems. So really just dialing it back. And then anyhow, we get to, I guess right before main pits, we pass Dan Fresh. And, you know, and Dan Fresh, I mean, I'm not going to say he's my idol, but he's been the 4500 icon since we started. So, like, when we passed Dan Fresh in his 4800 car, man, I'm like, this is it, man. Like, we, you know, we're doing something today. You know, we got Fresh, man. We got to be doing good. So, anyhow, you know, we just kind of carried that confidence throughout the rest of the race. Our pit crew did an amazing job at every stop. We kept the tires under the car. You know, the Yokohama tires are probably – or not even probably, they are, you know, the Yokohama tires, they're the best tires that we've had on this 4500 car since we started racing it. So, you know, that's a huge deal too, man. You know, anytime you have, you know, a flat, it's just like a mechanical issue. I mean, you're having to get out, you're having to fix it, and then you're having to get back in, and you're having to get back on track. You know, and when you eliminate all those getting out, getting in, getting back on track, I mean, you're just going to have a way better day. It's going to be way faster, and everything's going to be way smoother. You're going to have more energy, you know, it's just going to be better. So after years of beating our head against the wall, we finally, you know, ran through Turkey Claw, and our pit never really told us what position we were in, but I knew, yeah, I was like, man, we got to be, you know, in the top two. Like, you know, if we're not winning this thing, we're getting back on the podium. I think in 2020, we'd finished second place. And even though that was a great feeling, it really just pissed me off, you know, because I'm like, man,
so
we
close.
Came so far. And, you know, Dan Fresh is standing here in his street clothes. Like, he'd been here for an hour. Like, you know, what is he doing that we're not doing? Like, man, come on. But anyway, so we ran through Turkey Claw and we knew everything was going good. You know, we made the backwash. And, like, I would say from Turkey Claw to the finish line is probably, in my opinion, the roughest part of the entire course. Like, just little whoops and canyons and twisty turn things, man, where you really can't get a rhythm. You really can't go real fast, but, you know, you don't want to be going slow. So anyway, I just told Jeremy, I was like, man, we're just going to go as fast as we can comfortably, you know, and not tear this car up. So we made it through that section, you know, came around back through the short course. Took the checkered flag, man, and I was like, you know, we were kind of looking around and everybody's all super excited. I'm like, man, you know, we did something today, man. We're, you know, hell, we're probably like in the top five. And we got up there and they said that we'd finished third place overall and first in class, man. It was just amazing.
Pretty good feeling.
Oh yeah. I mean, you know, I mean, I told several people, you know, since we'd won that I felt like it's a long time coming. But, you know, I hate to say that because there's so many people that have been out there to the desert that haven't finished.
Right.
So, I mean, we're fortunate, you know, long time coming or not, man. A lot of luck was on our side. A lot of excellent marketing partners. A lot of excellent pit crew. Just tons of knowledge and experience, you know, going into it. And, you know, and knowing the car, knowing what the car can take and what the car can't take. And not pushing the car beyond its limits.
And it's still that Jimmy's chassis?
Yeah, still the same chassis.
Excellent.
We've modified the steering a little bit because, you know, we've had so many problems early on. It has a really unique cantilever bell crank style steering on it, which makes it drive at high speeds really good, really stable, no bump steer. Doesn't really have a lot of like flex steer when you're in the rocks and doing stuff like that. It stays on track really good. But the cantilever, even though we thought it'd be really good and we thought it'd take a lot of pressure off the gearbox, I feel like it puts twice as much pressure on the gearbox.
Okay.
And the first couple seasons, man, we were breaking box after box after box. And, you know, Tom at PSC was super great. You know, he helped us out and, you know, he did as much as he could to, you know, get our car where it was. But, you know, ultimately we ended up hooking up with Sean and John and Kevin Rantz.
Right.
And we had them guys build us basically a power steering box that could take the kind of abuse that we needed it to take. But, you know, at the same time, we had switched to what they call a servo. And it's real similar to an orbital valve, but it actually has an output shaft. And if the output shaft doesn't feel any resistance, then it doesn't work. So like with the orbital valve, you don't have the output shaft and it doesn't need any kind of resistance at all, except for the input. When you turn the input, it diverts hydraulic pressure and the wheels turn. Well, with the servo, you still have to maintain the mechanical linkage because the output of the box has to feel some type of restriction or tension before it'll actually turn the wheels.
Okay.
So going to a servo and going to a box that was built, you know, by Mud Nut Racing and the Rance Boys, man, which those dudes are super awesome, man. They're like, they're some of my best friends that, you know, we had met through racing. But that really got our car back on track. Maybe probably around 2020, 2019, 2020, we'd switched over to that steering platform. And that's when, you know, we really started to be able to push the car and not worry about it breaking so much.
Right. Cool. So let's talk about, this is going to be a funny one. I remember one time you got red carded at a Dirt Riot race in Bridgeport. Have you ever been red carded before or after that?
No. That was the first time that we ever had been red carded. And fortunately, you know, we've never been red carded after that.
You won the red card. So
yeah, it actually was a guy by the name of Jason. And I don't even know what kind of GP he had. I think he had maybe a YJ. And he was relatively competitive, but I feel like, you know, we beat him probably like 98% of the time. And any time that, you know, we would show up, you know, you could just see it in his face, man. Like, he's just like, oh, man, these guys are here. And multiple times throughout, you know, racing Dirt Ride with that guy, he had actually, you know, tried to run us off the course, you know, like tried to go tire to tire, you know. And, you know, of course, you know, you don't want to go tire to tire at any speed.
No.
You know, it's going to be bad for both parties. So anyway, you know, we had always avoided any kind of confrontation, but, you know, out of respect for you and the series and, you know, mostly being banned, we didn't punch that guy in the face. But you know, we wanted to, you know, I've never really disliked a fellow racer as much as that guy. And Jason's probably a really good guy, man, but he just knew every button to push. Like, he, you know, it's like he got inside my psyche, man, and he just knew, like, this is going to piss him off. This is going to make him mad. No, let's do this. Let's do that. And same with my co-driver at the time, Groundy. Like, you know, I had to throttle Groundy back so many times. He's like, I'm beating that guy's ass. It's like, no, man, you know, we won't be able to come back, man. Like, this, you know, we'll get it. But anyway, I don't even remember exactly why he red carded us. I think he said we cut course because we passed him somewhere. But, you know, we went through the entire red card process, you know, and you guys got the three people, you know, the drivers to come up and make a decision. And we won the red card. And, you know, actually at that point in time, if you filed a red card, you had to pay $100.
Yep.
And if you won, you got your $100 back. And if you didn't win, then the person that you filed the card on got the $100. So we got the $100, you know, so we were super happy, you know. We had to deal with all the BS, but we got the $100. And later that night, we were all like at a Pizza Hut. And him and his team were in there at the Pizza Hut, you know, and they were mad because we beat them and they lost the $100. And anyway, you know, of course, we were probably drinking. And somebody with us was like, you know, what are we going to get? You know, what are we going to get? And I was like, shit, we got $100. We can get whatever we want. You know, of course, we said it loud enough, you know, make sure their team knew that they heard it, you know. And they, you know, we're kind of a rowdy group to be around. So, you know, they really didn't want to take it beyond that. They just kind of sit over there and look down at their food and just let us be boisterous and arrogant and all that.
Awesome. So give me the story about how you became popular in China.
Oh yeah. Well, Dave Collin hit me up, man, and I really just kind of started racing for Ultra 4. So Dave Cole, he calls me up and he's like, "Hey man, you know, you want to go to China?" I'm like, "China? What do you mean I want to go to China?" You know, and I knew some of the people that we had competed with, you know, like Justin Hall and Jesse Haynes, you know, like they had been to Japan with We Rock. And I'm like, "We're going to China?" And he's like, "No, we're not going to China." He said, "I've got a deal worked out. We went to China last year and they want us to come back. And, you know, I've got some cars over there. And, you know, we're going to go over there. We're going to race these cars and we're going to put on some shows." He's like, "You know, but you need 2 weeks off work. And I'll call you back. I'll let you know the details. I'll call you back. But are you interested in going?" I was like, "Well, I mean, yeah, I'm interested in going. But, you know, it's really open-ended at this point. Like, you know, you don't have any time frame. You don't, you know, yes. Okay, yes." So anyway, he's like, "Okay, I'll call you back." So I tell my wife, I was like, "Hey, I might be going to China." And she's like, "You're not going to China." And anyway, I was like, "Yeah, you know, maybe I am." So anyway, maybe 2 or 3 weeks go by and Dave Cole calls me up, you know, after church on Sunday. He's like, "Hey man, I got all the details, you know, we want you to go." So anyhow, it all worked out and I got to go to China with, you know, a bunch of great guys from Ultra 4 and a bunch of guys from King of Hammers. So we get there and basically we're racing each other, you know, cause we're competitive. But we're all mic'd up, and it's kind of an orchestrated race. Like, Dave's going to pick who wins, and he's going to pick who, you know, hits the wall and who spins out and who does what. So, you know, we're all out there driving around, you know, as fast as we can. And he's like, "Okay, man, slow down." And we're like, "Man, I ain't fucking slowing down." Like, I just, you know. So, anyhow, it's a bunch of egos out there, and, you know, Dave's trying to, you know, corral us all in and make sure, you know, we're not killing each other or tearing the cars up, you know, because we really don't have, you know, good parts supply over there for, you know, the vehicles that we're driving. So anyhow, we're basically going from province to province, putting on like what I would consider like maybe a monster truck show, you know, right. Except we're racing these Ultra 4 cars, you know. So anyhow, we're all standing there and there's, you know, I don't even know, man, there's a 25,000 people or maybe 100. I don't even know, man. This huge facility that we're racing at, and it's packed. And they're like, "Okay, man, they're going to come over and they're going to ask your name and where you're from." And anyway, you know, we're sitting there just kind of talking amongst drivers. And I was like, "They're going to come ask us, you know, what our name is and where we're from." And they're like, "Yeah." Well, earlier that day, or maybe the day before, Stan, my buddy Stan Hayes, he had actually ramped the car off in this pond, more or less. You know, it was kind of a rock crawling course, but it was just full of water. So anyway, he ramped the car off in there and blew a motor up. So, you know, we were down a car and Dave was in a really terrible mood. He was super pissed at, you know, the world. So anyway, I was like, "Man, I'm going to tell him I'm Ricky Bobby from Talladega." And anyway, you know, we all start laughing and Matt Howell's like, "No, man, you can't do that. You know, you can't say that, man. Dave's pissed. Like, he's going to freak out." And I'm like, "Dude, you know, we're 2,000 miles away from home. Like, is he going to send me home? Like, what's, you know, whatever, dude. You know, I'm here to have a good time." So anyhow, they're asking, you know, people and, you know, none of these people in China, or I say none, you know, a very small percentage of the Chinese speak English. So, you know, and at the same time, I'm like, "Man, they don't even understand what we're saying." You know what I mean? They're here for the entertainment. They're having a good time. So this, you know, this beautiful Chinese lady that's putting the show on, you know, she comes over and she's like, you know, speaking to me in English and she's speaking to the translator in Chinese. And she's like, "So what's your name?" And I was like, "Ricky Bobby." And she kind of smiles, you know, like she don't really know who Ricky Bobby is. And she sure as hell don't know who I am. So anyway, she just kind of smiles and she's like, "Where are you from?" I was like, "Talladega, Alabama." And anyway, every single person that was with our group just totally lost it. Like, it was just a really funny time to say something like that. And Dave just busted up laughing. He's like, "Man, you know," he come over afterward. He's like, "Man, you really kind of pushed my button there for a second." He said, "But I really needed that, man. Like, that was funny as hell. Like, this is funny." So. But yeah, it was a super cool experience. Man, it was super cool.
I understand very that they grateful. were really amazed at your beard.
Yeah, they were. I had lots of people wanting to touch me, you know, and I'm not like a touchy-feely kind of guy. But yeah, it was super cool, man. You know, we were taking pictures and hugging babies and shaking hands, and it was one of the coolest Ultra 4 experiences, you know, by far that I've been able to take place, you know, or take part in.
Awesome. So what's on the horizon for Dwayne, family, come get you some, your racing career? What do you think?
Man, I really don't know. I just take it day by day. I guess first off, family would be the most important thing. Been married to my wife, Bethany, for 27 years.
Congratulations.
Have three grown up kids now. They all graduated college. They've all got their own jobs and careers.
Wow.
So, you know, we were, my youngest daughter was in high school. She was a senior. She was about to graduate and move to college. And at that point in time, me and my wife had actually gotten custody of two of my nephews. Their parents were in a bad way, and, you know, things just weren't going good. So, you know, we decided to step in and, you know, try to help this family out, which, you know, was our family. So we got my two nephews that moved in with us right around 2016 and May of 16. So now, fast forward to 2023, I still have the boys. They're basically my kids now. You know, they're 6 and 8. They're active in all kinds of different sports and hip hop dance and a bunch of different stuff that, you know, they like to do. So family life's really good. Just kind of hit reset on growing up some kids. My adult kids are doing great. My young kids are doing good. My wife's still doing great. I feel like we've got an awesome relationship. You know, I feel like we're going to be, you know, hopefully married, you know, until we part this earth. Nothing weird there. It's all cool. Come get you some. Yeah. Come get you some. Still going strong. I've got probably the best set of coworkers that I have had, you know, since we've had the business. So, the guys that, you know, I got in here working, you know, side by side with me every day are super good, man, super talented, with, you know, super well-rounded. You know, we do a lot of stuff. So business is going really good. We're really busy. Tax time stuff seems kind of weird since COVID, but, you know, springtime is always busy. So business is doing good. Super happy, super proud of, you know, all that and all the guys, whole crew. My wife, you know, gives me a pretty good leash on racing. Lets me, you know, kind of do what I want, you know, when I want. So got super excited about the EV program. We were one of the guys that got an EV package to build a car. Got hooked up with a really talented guy named Ross Pilgreen that has a Natural State Racecraft down here in Little Rock, Arkansas. Started, you know, getting a really good game plan on the EV stuff so we could build this cool car. Still, you know, 2 years later, still waiting. Haven't actually started construction of the car because, you know, we haven't got the 100% battery configuration, you know, and all the parts. Don't really know where that's headed because can't really get no replies. Feel like it, you know, unfortunately may not ever come to fruition, but we're hoping it does.
Right.
We still got the 4500 car. It's still doing great. We still plan on racing. At this point in time, we plan on racing every single Ultra 4 race that they have this year, with the exception of the event in Pennsylvania. And if something, you know, if we're going to the West Coast race first in Montana, if something happens there, really catastrophic, then, you know, we might look at Pennsylvania. But, you know, we just didn't plan on racing all three of the East Coast this year because we've only got to have two to be in for the series. And then I don't know. I mean, you know, I definitely plan on going back to KOH next year. You know, and right now I think, you know, we plan on racing the Ultra 4 Series again next year. Don't really plan on moving into a different class at this point. I wish the 4500 class would grow a little bit. I feel like it has shrunk a little bit since we started. Like, I think our first KOH, I think there was 42 competitors. And this year I think there was 31. So, you know, that's, you know, relatively 25% decline at KOH. So, you know, we don't want that. We want to be into something that's definitely growing. But, you know, I don't want to spend, you know, $100,000, $150,000 on a car that, you know, just to change classes.
Right.
Me and the other 4,500 guys, you know, what I would call the core 4,500 guys that have been racing the series and racing KOH and really been into it, are really trying to push to change the rule book just a little bit, to eliminate any kind of orbital valves because, you know, so many people have a weird misconception about the 4500 class and what's legal and what's not legal and what can you have and what can you not have. And I feel like we got a couple gray rules in the book that, you know, are hopefully or possibly prohibiting people from building 4500 cars. They just feel like it's easier to build a 4800 car, and it probably is. You know, not that shocks are, you know, cheap, but they only got to buy one shock per corner versus two, you know, that we can't have. I guess you don't, there's some 4500 cars that still have one, but most of them have two. And, you know, I feel like, I almost feel like I'm in the same kind of thing where I was with WeRock at this point. No one wants to spend $50,000 on a full-bodied car.
Right.
You know, when they can build a buggy. So that same, you know, kind of thought runs through my mind when I think, man, nobody wants to build a $100,000 race car when they know it's going to have a gearbox on it. So that's why, in my opinion, the 4800 class is a little more enticing, you know, and I feel like that's why that class is actually growing a little bit, because, you know, you can build the same kind of car for just a little bit less money, you know, not much less, you know, maybe not even any less, you know, based on some of those platforms that I'm seeing coming out. But, you know, and they can take that car and they don't have a steering box, you know, and they can do whatever they want to do. So I feel like, you know, if we don't get a rule change that, you know, it's going to really solidify our rules and clear them up, or, you know, on the, we've even discussed, you know, maybe allowing orbital valves. But then, you know, I think if we allow orbital valves, then that's going to put us virtually almost on the same platform as a 4800 car, and one of the classes is going to get eliminated.
True.
So I don't know. I would really love to see the numbers in the 4500 class grow. You know, me and, you know, and the other core 4500 guys, you know, the only way that we can foresee this happening is to get a couple rule changes, you know, to solidify the rules so people aren't so scared or aren't so nervous. You know, they know exactly what they can use. They know exactly what they can't use. You know, and this year at KOH, we actually did, you know, we made a little bit of progress. Everybody had to go take their cars to the tech tent and unhook your steering ram. And if you couldn't drive your car without your ram on it, it wasn't a 4500 legal car. So that, you know, and I think, I don't know. I mean, obviously I don't know, but I think that's why that a few of the cars dropped off this year, because they knew they couldn't steer their car without the ram. They knew that they had basically what we would consider a cheater car, and they weren't going to get called out on it. So they either took it all off and moved classes, or they just didn't show up.
Well, hopefully they fix them so that they are within the rules.
Well, you know, yeah, hopefully they do. You know what I mean? That way our numbers will continue to grow. And, you know, the good thing and the bad thing is, you know, Dave has been in control of the rule book for, you know, since it began. You know, it's his series. But now that Ultra 4 USA has purchased the series, and USAC is running the races, and Dave is in charge of Hammer King Productions. Now, from a racer standpoint, that's a little bit better, because now anything that takes place has to go through, you know, basically three organizations.
Right.
So, like, if, you know, not to say anything bad about Dave, I love Dave. You know, we all have our faults for sure, but everything with Dave is black and white. You know, it's like, no, it's my way. We're doing it this way. That's the way it's going to be. We're not changing it. And, you know, super hard to get him to change that mentality on certain things. You know, on some things he's super open. But, you know, on the rule book stuff especially, it's super hard for him to even want to buckle a little bit. But now that he doesn't have 100% say, you know, I feel like we're going to make some progress and hopefully grow the 4500 class, you know, back to, you know, what I would love to say, you know, comparable numbers to 48.
Cool. Excellent. So that, I think we've covered just about everything I can think of. Is there anything that, that you can think of we haven't covered?
Man, not really. We just kind of went through the whole...
the whole timeline.
The whole, yeah. Yeah, from the... yep. No, well, nothing I can think of, man. Just still keeping on. I definitely wanted to say thank you. Probably 2 years ago. I think maybe when we got second place, you and Shelly sent me a actual, like a postcard, you know, congratulating me. And I never actually got to personally catch up with you and tell you thank you, man. That really meant a lot coming from you guys.
Well, you're welcome. That's that's something that's near and dear to Shelly's heart to do that. So
yeah, man, that's super awesome. I mean, when I got that, I was really, really felt it.
Excellent. Well, Dwayne, thank you so much for spending the time and having the conversation with us and letting people know more about Dwayne Garretson.
Yeah, man, I appreciate the opportunity very much.
Excellent. I'll be in touch and let you know when this thing's going to air. Thank you.
That sounds awesome. Thank you, sir.
All right. You take care.
All right. Have a good night.
Bye.
Bye.
Well, that's another episode of Conversations with Big Rich. I'd like to thank you all for listening. If you could do us a favor and leave us a review on any podcast service that you happen to be listening on, or send us an email or a text message or a Facebook message, and let me know any ideas that you have, or if there's anybody that you have that you think would be a great guest, please forward the contact information to me so that we can try to get them on. And always remember, live life to the fullest. Enjoying life is a must. Follow your dreams and live life with all the gusto you can. Thank you.